Blog Talk Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to another edition of False Count Radio. As always, I am your host, the Pacific Coast player, JT Evans. And tonight, alongside me as my co-host, I have the outsider, Andrew Carluck. How are you?
I'm doing good, JT. How's it going? Ready to do this again?
It's going great, man. Earlier we interviewed Kid Cash, and right now on the air with us, we have ECW original Axel Rotten. Axel, how are you doing tonight?
Gentlemen, a pleasure to be on the air with you tonight. I'm doing great, man. I just got in from, of all places, hanging out at the gym. Then from there, I was actually reading some books. So I don't want to destroy that hardcore image, but I was taking some quality time reading books and surfing the internet. So that's what a chair swinging bloodthirsty freak does on a Wednesday night.
Oh, that's awesome. Now, we've had a lot of fans sending us questions. We've got some questions of our own, so if you don't mind, let's go ahead and get started.
Man, whatever you guys want to do, you know, one thing people know about me is that, you know, I'm not afraid to tell the truth and shoot and talk and even bury myself. So if someone's got a question, they want to know the truth, they want to know an answer. You know, the one good thing about me, and I've always said this, you know, I've never held back and I never will. I've got where I've gotten on my merit and not through kissing somebody's ass. So whatever, you know, questions anyone has, feel free, because I don't hold back. You want opinions, you want truths, you want facts, I'm your man. So, let's get into it, guys. I'm really looking forward to it.
All right. Of course, you know, we got a couple of the random generic questions that we ask every guest. Like, growing up, were you a professional wrestling fan? If so, who'd you look up to?
Yeah, well, of course. For me, wrestling was my grandfather, on my mother's dad. My grandfather was a huge wrestling fan, and I was exposed to, you know, the WWF back in like the early 70s when I was, when I was born in the early 70s. From the time I can recall, we would watch wrestling at 4 p.m. on Saturday afternoons. You know, my grandfather's, it was sort of like a tradition. And, you know, the guys that I grew up watching, you know, we're all, you know, the guys, Bruno was more toward the end of his career, you know, the mid-70s. You know, he had a few runs here and there, but, you know, his real heyday had come and gone. What I recall most from Bruno was his feud with Zbyszko in 1980, which was, you know, still, in my opinion, one of the best programs ever in wrestling. But the guys that really inspired me, and I don't think it's hard to tell when you watch me work, you know, is obviously Dusty Rhodes, you know, is a huge inspiration and was one of my personal favorites as a kid. And, you know, and also it's no secret that, you know, one of my other all-time favorites, of course, superstar Billy Graham. And a lot of people have, you know, if you watch some of the stuff that I do that's not the gory, crazy, bloody stuff, you realize, you know, I do a lot of stuff that Dusty Rhodes does. And, of course, my interview, not tooting my own horn, but, you know, been praised by a lot of the guys in the business that I look up to, guys like Terry Funk and you know, Shane Douglas and Raven and guys like that, who have said, you know, Axel Rotten is without a doubt one of the best promo guys in the business. Well, that's because I grew up watching guys like Dusty Rhodes, guys like superstar Billy Graham, who didn't need someone to hand them a script, who didn't need someone to tell them what to say, you know, because they were talented enough to generate their own type of heat, so to speak. And that's what really made me want to do this. You know, those guys, you know, they were, I thought, incredible. And a guy like Dusty Rhodes was head and shoulders above a lot of other guys. And you look at Dusty, he wasn't a bodybuilder like Billy Graham. You know, I mean, let's face it, if Billy Graham were 10, 15 years younger, he would have been Hulk Hogan. We all know this, you know what I mean? It's just, he was that guy. So, I mean, those are my two favorites.
Those are actually good people to look up to. And you're right when you say that, by watching is the best kind of people that have interview skills, is because they've watched the guys in the past and kind of adapted.
Yeah, well, I mean, what are these kids today really going to do? I mean, I'm not, you know, look, let me preface this by saying I'm not putting down Yes, I am. I'm putting down the way that the guys are being brought into the business now. I mean, I was going to be politically correct, but I'm going to tell the truth. The fact remains that the next generation or the last two generations of professional wrestlers that are being brought into this business are not even being brought in as professional wrestlers. They're being brought in as WWE entertainers. They're not being taught how to work. They're not being taught. There's no, nothing about, you know, like driving up and down the road, you know, working the same guys, you know, for 2-3 months in a row, you know, doing a program. Well, you know, I got the privilege of doing that where there's no territories for these guys. These guys all think professional wrestling is going to the gym, going tanning, getting your titties waxed, someone telling you what to say, and you going out there practicing your match all day, and then the TV cameras come on, and you guys do the best you can to have quote-unquote physicality without touching each other and no one chipping a tooth. That's what the next generation of pro wrestling is. And for the fans, it sucks because the fans are really getting cheated because guys like me, guys like Mick Foley, guys, I mean, go back to Sabu, Terry Funk, and I'm not just saying ECW guys. I'm talking about workhorses, guys like Bret Hart, Ric Flair. These guys were professional wrestlers. I mean, there was no family entertainment. You know, we were taught, you know, growing up to be, you know, a physical professional wrestler, not some kind of entertainer. You know, yeah, we were entertaining and we are entertaining, but we were wrestlers. These guys today, unfortunately, you know, who's going to teach them how to do an interview? I mean, yeah, you have some of the best guys in the back as agents, you know, that are very talented guys. But when you have, like, some college punk from Syracuse writing an interview for a guy like Ric Flair or Teddy Long or somebody who's been in this business 30 or 40 years, that's kind of not the way to go, in my opinion, you know.
I would agree with you. Now, one of our listeners wanted to know, how did you get the name Axelrotten?
Well, you know, it's you know, the misconception, of course, because of the everyone that knows me personally knows I'm a huge music fan, so the first thing they go to is Axl Rose from Guns N' Roses, which wasn't the case. I'm going to tell you how the name came about because I love music. It's probably the most important thing in my life. I love, you know, everything about me is a song or a lyric. So the name Rotten came from Johnny Rotten from the Sex Pistols. That was easy for me. And if you watch my very, very early stuff, I used to be from England. I would have British flag on my tights and all that stuff. And the gimmick was, you know, just a punk rock dude from England. And I didn't want to use the name Johnny Rotten. But, you know, oddly enough, you know, there's like 6 degrees of separation here. Like Johnny Grunge from Public Enemy used to wrestle as Johnny Rotten before he was Johnny Grunge. But I got Axel. Funny, it's crazy enough, it came from, I was sitting, I worked at a video store when I was a kid, and I guess I was about 15 or 16 years old, and I was watching Beverly Hills Cop, and Bronson Pinchot kept doing the thing with Axel Foley, and he was going, Aquel, Aquel, you know, and he kept saying Axel over and over, and I was like, huh, all right. Screw it, Axel Rotten. And I thought when you put that together, it almost sounded like, you know, a rock star or something that you didn't need nothing else. I mean, with a name like Axel Rotten, you really don't need, like, the Bone Crusher Axel Rotten because it sounds cool. The name itself is cool. You know, Axel Rotten is a cool-sounding name, so it was like, you know, oddly enough, it came from a combination of Eddie Murphy and Johnny Rotten. You know, that was where the name Axl Rotten came from. It had nothing to do with Axl Rose, which, you know, a lot of people always say, you know, Axl Rose. I'm like, no, it really nothing to do with that. So that's the origin of where the name came from.
Man, some of the best names come from just, you know, little things that you see on TV. It's awesome.
Well, think about it, man. It's like, you know, let's face it. Some of the best things in the wrestling business happen completely by mistake. All right, I'm going to tell you a story about something that happened completely by mistake. You know, in ECW, you know, in toward the end, about 98, when Al Snow came in, oddly enough, Al Snow's first opponent in ECW, Axel Rotten. Al Snow's last opponent in ECW, Axel Rotten. Anyway, just a bit of trivia. Al Snow, with the whole head gimmick, that head gimmick was not a thought out, you know, hey, I'm going to start coming out to the ring with a head. what happened is, if you guys know, every night, you know, the fans would bring us all these weapons, you know, for the trash can that we would use for, you know, for New Jack, you know, with myself and the Dudleys or whoever we were in the brawl with. And I think, you know, one night someone that mannequin head was brought for us to use as a weapon. And I think Al grabbed it out of the trash can and, you know, we get a couple seconds of thought going, hey, wow, let me grab that head. Or that head would have just ended up being in the ring and New Jack probably would have hit Bubba in the head with it. So that's what happened. I mean, like, by coincidence, you know, that head became a big deal in ECW. I mean, only because by pure accident. And another one of the great stories of pure accident was no one expected Steve Austin to get over. I mean, that gimmick, the ringmaster, was like an 800-pound like weight around his neck. You know, and he started going out there doing his own promos, and lo and behold, you know, got over by mistake. So, you know, like I said, my name was just something that came to me by just, like, watching a movie, you know, and it stuck, you know, since, you know, I came up with it in 87, you know, when I was 16 years old, you know, and I've had it ever since. So, you know, and it's cool. I've never changed. I'm one of the few guys that have been lucky enough to be me my whole career, you know what I mean? My partner, Christ, Balls Mahoney, he's been a Buddha Singh, Balls Mahoney, Santa Claus, you know, you name it, you know, and I've throughout that whole time, I've still been Axl Rotten, so it's been pretty cool, you know.
Oh, yeah. I wish mine was that cool, man. I remember when I was first training and everything, and they told me to go home and think of a name and bring it to them, and they'd look at it and go, yay or nay. I was picking through fucking PWI 500, just putting stuff together until I thought that something sounded cool.
Hey, you know what I mean? It whatever works for you, bro. It's like, let's, you know, I my theory on the whole gimmick and the whole thing is, like, I'm not so much, you know, a gimmick as I am me just turned up a little bit, you know what I mean? Because you know, if you see me walking down the street sometimes, the chances of you seeing me in a pair of you know, cut off like denim shorts and a sleeveless shirt are pretty good. So that's what I wrestle in most of the time. So, I mean, it's like, you know, it's not as if, you know, I put on some great big costume and become a different person. It's very much an extension of a real, you know, reality. But it also is, it's different for me in a lot of ways because, you know, so you don't want to become that guy, too. You know, everyone's like, hey, you know, I wasn't born Axl Rotten, so I got to remember that, you know, there's life outside of wrestling. And, you know, a lot of times some guys can't separate that, and, you know, and that becomes a problem, too. But, yeah, just, you know, sometimes the greatest things that ever happen are the greatest accidents, man. And, you know, however you come with your name or however it works, it's just, you know, just some guys, it's like, you know, another funny story, that the name Just Incredible, you know, one of the guys who in ECW, who was just one of the ring guys, you know, came up with that name for himself, you know, but it sort of really didn't fit him, you know what I mean? And PJ was given, you know, the name, you know, Just Incredible. The guy who came up with it later became, it was Wild Bill. He wrestled as Bilvis Wesley or something, but I'm talking about, that was when, like, ECW was like Titanic, you know, it was dying, you know, it was sinking, but, you know, that was, you know, something that he came up with. It was a real cool name, but, you know, he never got the chance to use, and luckily, you know, for PJ, it worked out for him.
Now, Axl, we all know that you were trained by Jumping Joey Maggs. Do you have any memories of working with him before he passed?
Oh, yeah, well, you know, the thing with Joey, I was actually trained by two guys, a guy named Jim Leon and Joey Maggs. They wrestled in the early 80s together down south. They had a tag team. They called themselves the Heavy Metal Connection. It was Bad Boy Ricky Lawless and Jumpin' Joey Maggs. They were the Heavy Metal Connection. They wrestled down south a lot. Joey and I are both from Baltimore, actually the same neighborhood. Literally grew up maybe 10 blocks from each other. And Joey was one of those guys that... if you watched him, you know, he did all the things that everyone probably should have done that made it, you know, other than the fact that, you know, Joey was, like, he was a little short, you know, but I mean, that didn't hurt him other than the fact that the period that he came along was, you know, the late 80s, you know, the mid to late 80s, Vince was pushing The Undertaker, Tugboat. I mean, these guys were all 6'7", 6'5", 400 pounds. where are you gonna, what are you gonna do with a 5'9", 220-pound, you know, porky little Italian guy? You know, WCW already had the Italian Stallion. You know, and Joey was a good wrestler. There was nothing, absolutely nothing wrong with his work. You know, he was a good-looking guy. He could go out there. The girls liked him. But, I mean, it just was, you know, he didn't do anything really special than any other 80s wrestler ever did. You know, had a nice mullet, a cute smile, and a nice pair of tights. You know, that only get you so far, you know. And but Joey was, on a personal level, one of the sweetest guys you could ever meet. I mean, you know, we've all had our differences, you know, before in the past. But when it got right down to it, before, I was lucky enough, you know, before Joey passed away, to be able to go over his house a few times, sit and talk with him, you know, and it was nice that he and I were able to make sure that we were good, which we were. And when he passed away, you know, I had no guilt or anything, you know, reconciled in my mind. Everything was fine, you know. So yeah, I have really nothing bad to say about him. You know, he was a really nice dude.
Okay. He sounds like a great guy. And if I'm not mistaken, you in turn went and trained Ian Rotten. What are some of your memories of training him, and was he a quick learner?
You know, I'll tell you what, John, like, he loved wrestling. There's no doubt in my mind, you know, and he was dedicated to learning. I mean, you know, he showed up all the time. Excuse me, I had to grab a drink of soda. He would train hard. He trained hard, and, you know, he was one of the guys that, without question, he wanted it, man. He wanted it bad. And he was willing to do whatever it took, you know, to succeed. But you know, the thing with he and I is it became, you know, some sort of personal indifference where, you know, we really didn't get along, you know, and it was like, you know, since that time has passed, you know, he's said some things about me that weren't true. I've said some things about him that weren't true. I've said some things about him that were true, and he said some things about me that were true. But, you know, the majority of it is I genuinely, you know, I think that John, you know, Ian is probably a good dude. But, you know, he would much rather talk crap on other people and, you know, just not let, you know, which is sad because, there was a time when I thought his wrestling ability was getting pretty darn good, but he just, like, decided he'd be better off and just cut yourself and roll around in, you know, AIDS-infected, you know, needles or something. But it just was like, you know, I thought there for a while he would have had the ability to go and be a very good, you know, wrestler or entertainer. But I think, you know, for the most part, a lot of the stuff that he did was, you know, I thought a lot of stuff that I did was way over the top. So I thought some of the stuff that, like, him and, like, Pondo and Necro and all those guys did was just absurd, you know. And I thought that it really became something that overshadowed anything that had to do with wrestling ability. It just had to do with being stupid. And I don't think that any time, you know, if people want to pay to see stupidity, that's what Johnny Knoxville does or Steve-O. You know, you don't need wrestlers to go out there and just, you know, throw themselves through glass and almost kill each other. And the reality of it is guys for, what, 30, 40 bucks a night? Because you know these guys aren't getting paid nothing, you know? So it's like, why do it? But, you know, Ian was one of those guys, you know, that, you know, he loved wrestling. He probably still does love wrestling, you know? Unfortunately, I think, you know, and this is coming from me, a guy who's had a lot of issues with people on a personal level. He's got the one of deals where, you know, you say his name in pretty much any locker room and someone's going to have a story as to why they don't like him, you know, and that's just the, you know, the fact that it's become that way. And you know, a lot of that does happen with running your own promotion. You know, he runs that IWA Mid-South. You know, when you run your own wrestling promotion and you're not paying people and you're bringing guys in and then you can't pay them, you know, you get that reputation of being a jerk and a dick. You know, when a guy comes in and he does the job that you brought him in for, then you don't pay him, you know, that's pretty bad. And you know, Ian has done that on more than a couple hundred occasions. So, I mean, you know, that's the reputation that he's garnered as a guy who's a prick because, you know, he'll you know, just so you know, one time, you know, I got pissed off, you know, he brought me out there and not only did he not pay me, but didn't get me a place to stay, and I ended up sleeping in Midway Airport. Now, I'm not saying enough for me. You know, I was upset for me, but I was more upset that the guy sleeping next to me on the bench next to me was Ricky Morton, because, I mean, that's talking about being disrespectful to one of the greatest, you know, in my mind, tag team wrestlers of all time, one of the greatest workers ever, Ricky Morton, a guy who knew how to draw money, a guy who was great at what he did. You put him out there with Ric Flair, you get a five-star match. You put him and Robert out there with the Midnight Express, you get a five-star match. And here I am sleeping in an airport because Ian, you know, didn't buy Ricky Morton, one of the greatest wrestlers of all time, a hotel room. So that's the kind of guy he turned out to be. In the beginning, I had nothing but praise for the guy. He worked his ass off, but, you know, my last recollections and memories of him, you know, of being around him, I don't choose to be around him now. And as a shoot, him and I don't talk, you know, and I have no desire to talk to him, you know, at all.
Now, one of our listeners, Frank, actually sent in a question. The question was, what are your memories of running the Universal Independent Wrestling in Maryland, which during its time had Bam Bam Bigelow and Scotty the Body, who later became Raven?
Oh, yeah. It was called UIW, Universal Independent Wrestling. What we did was we had an opportunity to put on a TV show, and we had an ABC station down here, an ABC affiliate that gave us, it was Sunday nights into Monday morning. It was one of the greatest time slides, 12:30 a.m. to 1:30 a.m., but oddly enough, we were up directly against WCW main event, you know, so we actually got better ratings than them, but it was like we had a great time doing that stuff. I mean, like, I brought in, you know, we brought in Bigelow. I think I actually wrestled Bigelow on one of the shows. We brought in Mick Foley, came and worked for us. Scotty came and worked. See, you know, it was about Raven. Title Match Wrestling did a shoot interview with me, Raven and I, a couple months ago that's out now. I think you can go to titlematchwrestling.com and order it. And Raven and I have been wrestling, you know, really the same exact length of time, you know, and broke in together and have known each other literally since 1987. So, I mean, he and I go so far back. Anytime I could run a show and I could afford to do it, I'd always use Raven. I don't care if he was, you know, Scotty Anthony, Scott Levy, Raven, Johnny Polo, you know, I could care less what he was. I was always a big friend and a fan of him and his work, and I still am to this day, you know what I mean? So he's one of those guys that if I ever run a show, he's in my top five of the first people I'll call, because I'll always want to have Raven, you know, if I can help it on my shows. He's one of those guys. We had a great time running those shows. Unfortunately, you know, we didn't draw a lot of people. It wasn't, you know, we didn't do great business as far as attendance goes, but the TV show itself was pretty good, you know, because it was here was this wrestling television show that people hadn't seen before. So it was something definitely different, something new. And even when, I'll tell you a story, well, Kurt Hennig told me about one time when I guess the WWF was in town. They were sitting up, and they actually watched it, and he was telling me how you know, he really enjoyed the show because of how fresh it was with the you know, just guys who are working hard. And so we had a good time running those shows.
What were the circumstances with the UIW closing in the mid-90s?
It was nothing more than financial. I mean, it was like the people that backed it, you know, was an attorney and her husband who had a television production company. And, you know, we weren't generating revenue. You know, it was difficult to, you know, sell advertisement, and because this was our thing. We had to, you know, go out, promote the shows, sell tickets, you know. Everything was, you know, was grassroots. We were out, you know, Ian and I trying to sell television advertisement as well. So, I mean, it was like, you know, we were trying to produce a wrestling show, a television show, and live events at the same time. So financially, it just became, you know, too much. We couldn't do it. And like a lot of smaller promotions, just couldn't hang in there. You know, we couldn't do it. The production costs for the television were coming too much to where, you know, no one was seeing a profit. And at that point, you know, the people that invested their money want to continue to be on board a sinking ship, much like WCW to a smaller scale. You know, there was no profit being made and money was being put out.
Yeah, you just mentioned WCW, and I know after UIW, you went into the WCW for a little bit of time, where you feuded with PN News. Do you have any memories of that era of your career?
Sure. You know, it was interesting because I went to after UIW, I went to the Global Wrestling Federation in Texas with you know, like the Patriot. Who else was down there in the very beginning? It was at any rate, I went down to Joe Pedicino was starting the Global Wrestling Federation in Dallas, the Sportatorium, and oddly enough, a couple weeks after doing a few tapings, I got a call from Jody Hamilton, who was working for WCW at the time, and said that they wanted me to come down and do a tryout. And oddly enough, one of my tryout matches was against Joey Maggs. But it was funny because I got my my tryout with WCW not off of them seeing me wrestle. It was off of them hearing me cut a promo. They happened to be watching the Global television show, and I started come on and did a promo, and they wrote my name down and said, hey, let's give this guy a chance. So, you know, I went to WCW and worked with PN News for like a month straight. Took the one-man gang spot because he had gotten fired, so they needed someone to wrestle with PN News. I was still very young at the time. So there was a lot of, like, politicking going on that I wasn't aware of, you know, and I rode and roomed with Mick Foley at the time and traveled with him and Abdullah the Butcher. So I got to learn a lot on the road. But, you know, I got my first real taste of, like, locker room politics, you know, with dealing with guys that were the agents and the bookers on the road, you know, how they would favor one guy over another guy and tell one guy to do one thing. And then when the office guys like Dusty or Jim Herd would see it and that wasn't what they told them to do, they'd stooge it off on the other dude and he'd get fired. You know, and it was back then WCW was in a lot of shambles. I mean, when you had – like Jim Herd involved and you know, I wrestled Matt Bourne one night, who was Big Josh, at Greensboro Coliseum, you know, and I was just happy to be there. But I mean, this wasn't the NWA that I remembered or WCW, because I mean, I was used to watching those tapes of Dusty and Nikita and the Greensboro Coliseum and the place so loud that the camera was rattling. Man, I showed up at Greensboro, there may have been 2,000 people in that arena, you know, that held, you know, what, 18,000? So the writing was on the wall even back then with WCW. Man, that was one of the low periods. It was bad, you know what I mean? It was really bad. And Halloween Havoc, I think it was Halloween Havoc 91, I was scheduled to be on there. That would have been the first pay-per-view I was ever on. I was supposed to wrestle Vader. But someone got hurt, and they end up putting Vader in that stupid Chamber of Horrors match where they did the gimmick where they put, like, Abdullah the Butcher in, like, the electric chair. It was just horrible. But, you know, that's my, you know, recollection of WCW. I'll just say that I wasn't a big fan of Grizzly Smith, who was Jake the Snake Roberts' father, who was one of the agents at the time. He was, you know, I think he's dead now, so... You know, I can't say anything. He and I just didn't gel, you know, and he liked the PN News thing and that's what he wanted to push. And to me, it was a natural, man. You had a guy who was a rapper going against a guy who was a punk rock dude, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s. Well, that's quite a natural feud. You could have really built that thing, you know, with the rap guy fighting the rock and roll dude. But they, you know, WCW at the time had no clue how to lace a shoe, you know, let alone put together a good angle. So it was pretty bad.
Well, what was the locker room like in that era?
You know, it was strange because the talent pool was fine. I mean, you know, you had Lex Luger, Sting, Austin, Scott Hall, Mark Merrow, Terry Taylor, Ricky Morton, Tommy Rich. I mean, you're talking a lot of talented guys. Now, the atmosphere in the locker room scene, the Dustin Rhodes was just starting out, and Mark Merrow, I don't know if I mentioned him, but, I had a good time. The only time that, like as I said, I didn't, feel like comfortable there was dealing with Grizzly Smith. But other than that, the whole time, on the road in WCW, with traveling with guys, like Mick Foley and Abdullah the Butcher every day, the Freebirds were there, Jimmy Garvin and Michael Hayes, Bobby Eaton. You talk about great wrestlers. It was like a great atmosphere to be around. But it was just a low point in the company where they really weren't drawing a lot of people. I think Luger was the champion at the time. And I'm not really quite sure, but I think that was what was going on. But it wasn't so it wasn't a real high point as far as attendance goes for WCW at the time.
All right, you mentioned a few minutes ago about you in Global. That's where I first became aware of you. I remember as a child being shocked when I found out you weren't from England. you also mentioned some of the names you couldn't remember, and that was actually my next question. Some of the names that you worked with were future superstars such as Booker T, John Hawk, who later became JBL. What are some of your memories of working with those stars and your time there in Global?
Sure. Now that you mentioned it, when the first time through there, I was by myself and wrestled guy. My feud was with Adrian Street. If you remember Exotic Adrian Street from back in the day with Miss Linda, he's like, and it's funny because Adrian came up to me, and he's like, "Hello, love. So where are you from?" I'm like, "Baltimore." He goes, "Oh my goodness, it's for sure. I thought you were from England. Oh dear, I'm like, and I was just laughing. And he goes, Linda, come here. This chap is not even from England. Oh, my goodness, he pulled it on us all, didn't he? And I was like, yeah, because I'm not, And he and Linda were just amazed that I wasn't from England. Another one that was at the time was Steve Austin's wife. They called her, what was her name, Blossom or whatever? She was from England. Jeannie, I think. I can't remember her name, but she was English, too. And she says, so where are you from? I'm like, Baltimore. She goes, oh, really? I was like, yeah, but . But yeah, wrestling with like Booker T and Stevie Ray was really cool. But they weren't very good back then,
Right.
Booker T to me was always head and shoulders a better wrestler than Stevie. But Stevie, wasn't bad and was a great guy. So together they obviously knew what they were doing. The combination Harlem Heat, was something, like 20 time tag team champions. So obviously they knew what they were doing. Now on the other hand, JBL or John Hawk, I had the pleasure of wrestling him and Bobby Duncombe Jr., who has since passed away. I get so tired of saying that. I talk about all my friends that are dead, the older I get, the more I realize that, those people had me written off for so many years, but John or JBL at the time, or John Hawk, who was JBL, so he was just terrible. And he'll be the first to tell you, if he wasn't 6'7", he probably would have been wrestling. But I got along with him tremendously. Still to this day, I think John's a good dude. Never had a problem with him. He hated Ian, Bobby Duncombe Jr. They both hated Ian. They couldn't stand him. Rugged Rod Price, they couldn't stand Ian either. It was like, everyone hated Ian. I don't know what it was, but I got along fabulously with all those guys, And JBL would come over to the apartment and be like, "Hey Axel, what are you doing, buddy? You wanna go out to eat? Hey Ian, you fat prick," and wouldn't invite him, So it was pretty funny. But yeah, that was like the dynamic down there though, man. I'll tell you what, in Texas I had an opportunity to wrestle with a lot of good guys, man. I'm talking like, now it's starting to come back to me, guys like, Kerry Von Erich, got to work with him one time before he died. Black Bart, who was great. you know, guys like Gary, guys who weren't really big national stars. I'm talking like Gorgeous Gary Young was really good. Hollywood John Tatum, you know, working with Rod Price. These guys, Iceman King Parsons, who was tremendous. You know what I mean? So I mean, I got the opportunity down there to learn a lot of good stuff. You know, and it was an awesome time for me in Dallas. We had a great time down there.
Right. Yeah. Because I remember when you wrestled Bobby Duncombe and John Hawk. That was when your first title. You won the global tag team titles. What were your memories about your first belt?
It was weird because we won the belts like right when Global was like actually finishing up. They had just learned that they lost their contract with ESPN, you know what I mean? So we were the last guys to ever hold the belts as far as that goes because they lost the deal with ESPN, and then they tried to hold on for a little bit after that doing some syndicated stuff. But Sportatorium at that point was dead. I was just happy I've had the opportunity to have wrestled in the world famous Sportatorium in Dallas, Texas, you know, and to have been able to do that, you know, I was happy, you know, to have gone through there and done that stuff. As I said, these guys nowadays really don't know what they're missing. You know, no, there's never going to be another Sportatorium. You know, there's never going to be the opportunity to wrestle every Monday night at the Mid-South Coliseum. You know, I got to do all that stuff, you know, and, you know, those are things that, you know, you can't teach these young guys anymore because they'll never get it. But, you know, those are great experiences for me.
All right. Now, we have a caller on the line here, so I'm going to go ahead and put them on. Hello, caller. You're on with Axel. Hello, caller. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, Axel, I was always wondering, why did they always put you down in ECW when you were actually, you could see some of the guys knew the business and some were like, always got pushed ahead and you got pushed down. It felt like they would not put you as a champion. You were always like a brawler or a goon.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny because it's a great point because Shane Douglas made that point one time about me. He said, he goes, you can take, you know, he's saying to Paul Heyman, he goes, you can take a guy like Axel Rotten, bury him under 10 tons of concrete, and the fans are still going to cheer for him because he's got talent. Now, there was always some underlying tension between me and Paul. I don't know exactly what it was, but I think a lot of times he got just tired of everyone telling him how much he should be doing with me that he wasn't doing with me. And I think he resented it a little bit because everyone from, you know, from Raven to Douglas to Funk to Sabu to everyone was telling him, you know, for Candido, they would all say, you know, you got to do this with Axel, you got to do that with Axel, you got to do this with Axel. And he would just, I think he resented it more than anything, you know, And there was a couple of personal issues, you know, him and I got into it, but I don't really have any, you know, ill feelings toward Paul at all. I think he's great, but I don't know what happened. And as far as, like, the brawling stuff, that came about simply because I was willing to do it. It had nothing to do with, in the very beginning, when Ian and I did that stuff, you know, it's because we were asked to do it. People have a tendency to forget that, you know, I did all that stuff way before any of the rest of those guys. I mean, the first person to do, you know, was me. The first person to do barbed wire bat in ECW arena was me. First person to use thumbtacks in ECW arena was me. All these guys, you know, this guy's a hardcore icon, this guy's an innovator of violence, this guy's that. You know, I'm the guy that did all that stuff. So, you know, that only because I didn't care to do it. So that's one of the reasons I did all that stuff.
I remember when you brought glass to the ring. In that door that you brought up I think it was the TV title match that you had.
Yeah, I can't remember.
It was in the old Hammerstein ballroom. The reason I remember because I remember watching you. It was you were going against RVD and Sabu.
Right.
And of all the, I mean, like you said, a lot of the fans gave the weapons to the guys. I remember coming in there with my best friend, and we gave you the door, and it was used as like a table.
Yeah, and we've done that a couple times with doors. Yeah, you know, because one time we got a door, and it was like, man, I forgot who it was. Man, you can't slam me through that. It's not going to break. But, you know, those doors, man, they would explode too, you know, like sometimes better, louder than the table because there was two thin plies of wood on them. They were pretty bad.
Yeah.
But all right, Carl.
Like
thank you for calling in.
Okay, thanks, man.
Hey, thanks, man. Thanks for the call.
All right. Thank you very much, Carl, for calling in. My next question for you actually was, how did you get your start in ECW?
We were running these couple like independent UIW and other things down here in Baltimore, and actually Ian booked Paul Lee to come down and just manage on the show. And when he came down, you know, it was when Eddie Gilbert was still the booker in ECW, but Paul said, hey man, why don't you guys come up, you know, we're doing this thing in Philly, you know, you'd be good for it. Why don't you guys come up, you know? And I couldn't work that show, and my back was really bothering me. So Ian teamed up with Jason Knight, wrestled Public Enemy in his first match. And then I came in later, and we teamed up. But that's how it happened. Just now, I knew Paul from WCW. He was in there when I was there. You know, he was with the Dangerous Alliance or whatever it was back then. And he and I, you know, had met, and, you know, so when he came to Baltimore, he was like, you know, hey, come up here to Philly, and, you know, you guys would be perfect for this thing that we're doing. And that's how it came about, you know, and this was 1993. I mean, you want to talk about, you know, ECW original. I'm the definition of an ECW original because I was in ECW when it was still called Eastern Championship Wrestling, you know, before it was even Extreme Championship Wrestling. So, I mean, I remember back when, you know, we had to ask the fans to all sit on one side of the building so it looked like we had people in the building. You know, that's how bad it was. So, you know, that's how we got started.
Yeah, that's old school stuff right there. That's nostalgic. One of our listeners actually wanted to know, and he's a huge Pitbull Gary Wolf fan. He says, what are your memories of wrestling the Pitbulls at November to Remember 1994, where you and Ian were forced to split as a team?
Well, we weren't forced because that was my idea. Like I told you that, Ian and I really weren't getting along. And I told Paul, I said, look, if I got a team with him anymore, I'm just gone. I quit. I'm leaving. You know what I mean? And he's like, well, what do you suggest we do, you know? And I'm like, I suggest we do whatever it takes to not have me team with him anymore. And we came up with a losing team split-up match. I'll tell you what, I can't recall the dates or the shows. But I'll tell you, I had a lot of really fun matches with Gary and Anthony with the Pitbulls. We did a couple double dog collar matches that were tremendous with those guys. One in the arena was really good. There was an angle that we shot one time where we came out and hit the ring, and we attacked them with their chains. And I remember I laid Anthony out with his chain, and he bled so bad. I mean, it was like literally like with a river running down his head. I mean, he was so, you know, and I was beating him with the chains. Those guys, I'll tell you what, I don't ever recall having a bad match with Gary and Anthony. I thought that, you know, and now that I'm thinking about it, I really never said this too much. You know, when people ask me who are my favorite people to wrestle in ECW, it always slipped my mind how much fun I had wrestling with the Pitbulls because, you know, we always had good chemistry together. We all got along well. We had good matches. And, you know, and it's not oddly enough, but, you know, just to prove that point, in like 1998 when I helped start Maryland Championship Wrestling, you know, I always booked the Pitbulls down here too at MCW because, You know, they were a couple guys that I thought, you know, were cool dudes, and did their job, and they looked like wrestlers. So I really enjoyed working with Gary and Anthony. I mean, hey, Gary, I hope those hot dogs are good, by the way. I'll take one with ketchup and relish, brother. So, you know, yeah, those guys, were. I really enjoyed wrestling with the Pitbulls, always. Never had a bad match with them.
Now, after that, when you and Ian split up, you had a really brutal feud. The culmination of that was the Taipei Death Match. Whose idea was that, and what are some of your memories of that match?
I think, you know, well, the first thing, the thing that got me about it was when we started the program together, the feud, our very first match, Ian, I mean, I beat the piss out of him, and he, like, pinned me with, like, a screw job finish. And then our second match out of nowhere was a barbed wire baseball bat match. And I'm going to tell you why that was. Because the main event advertised for the show was, like, Sandman against a mystery opponent, and they sold no tickets. And that was actually the night that Terry Funk came back, which came to known as Return of the Funker. But no one knew it, so no one was buying tickets. They announced the barbed wire baseball bat match. You know, the place was packed. So the Taipei Death Match was just like, you know, we were like, you know, well, what can we do? I mean, we let's do something really just, you know, stupid, different, you know. And Ian, I think, came up with the idea of, I think it came from a Jean-Claude Van Damme movie. I think it was from Bloodsport or something, where they had some karate match over there, one of those underground tournaments where the guys put glass on their hands. You know, I'm like, you know, hey, I don't care. I'll do it. You know what I mean? And here's the thing about those things. Like those barbed wire baseball bat matches, those Taipei death matches and all that stuff, there was no video for us to look at and say, oh, that's how you do it. You know, we wrote that script. We invented that's how you do it because we were the first guys to ever do it. So it was like, you know, I've seen it now, like, you know, people doing, like, the glass matches and the barbed wire bat matches, and I just kind of laugh because it's like, you know, it's like I'm your father, you know. It's like, you know, you guys, you're all just my kids. You don't really understand how you're doing it, and you're not doing a good job, you know. Something I always would tell people that I trained, and I would still say it this day, I'd say, when you're as good as I am now, I'll be better, because I always, you know, I continue to learn, and, you know, those matches, like the Taipei Death Match, I go back, and I watch it, and I watch how, if you watch that match, it's just it's a wrestling match with a lot of blood in it. I mean, I let, you know, your hero Axel gets the shit kicked out of him most of the time, and he makes his triumphant comeback and wins, and the fans go crazy. That's what it was. I mean, it was the same thing as any other match, except we had fists, you know, with glass on our fists, and there was a lot of blood. But at that time, no one had seen such stuff. So, you know, you watch the photographers around ringside, the international press, and everyone else was going crazy because they had never seen anything that nuts. So, you know, it was. And I'll say this: what is it now? 2010, all right, and we're still talking about a match that happened 15 years ago. That's how much that match has meant to the lore and to the history of ECW. Is to this day, people still will talk about that match. People will take the videotape and the DVD of that match and show their friend, show their son, and then now a whole new generation of people are like asking me questions about that match because it had that much significance. And, you know, that's why when, you know, I would take ridicule from people of, oh, Axel Rotten, he's just a blood and guts guy. He doesn't know how to wrestle. He doesn't know this. He doesn't know that. And I would just say, you know, take a name out of any, just throw out a wrestler's name. I don't know. Let's say, you know, Billy Jack Haynes. No, I'm not saying nothing bad about Billy Jack. I'm just saying what I want you to do is name me one good Billy Jack Haynes match from 1995 right now. You can't. But think of, now I want you to say, what's your favorite Axel Rotten match from 1995? Oh, Taipei Death Match, barbed wire match. You remember that stuff. So I was making a little bit of history. So for all those people that were telling me for all those years I didn't know what I was doing and I was no good at what I was doing, they're still talking about me, you know. So obviously I knew what I was doing.
Yeah, well, I actually watched that match the other day. Now, right around the time that Sci-Fi was about to debut ECW, the WWE version of ECW, you were listed on the roster. I believe you were signed and never wrestled, and soon after that you were released.
Yeah,
what was the reasoning behind that?
I was one of the first, like, five or six guys brought in. You know, and I signed the WWE contract. I had it, you know, inked and signed, three-year deal, whatever. And, you know, I collected probably about, I don't know, $10,000, $15,000 worth of money from those guys. They were sending me a check every week. But when it came time to come do it, you know, I was really indifferent about it because I knew in my mind it was going to suck. And I was also, I had a lot of serious problems, you know, in my personal life, you know, with, you know, dealing with drugs and things like that. So wrestling, you know, for WWE wasn't high on my list of things to do, so I just didn't show up. You know, I just chose not to go, you know, and that's the hot and the cold of that entire story. I mean, there's no big, he got fired for this or he didn't. No, I just didn't go. You know, I decided one day that they needed me for Monday Night Raw in Pittsburgh, and I decided I'd rather be somewhere else doing something else, and I didn't show up. And that's it, you know, and that's the truth of it. You know, do I wish I would have shown up? Probably now. Sure, why not? Because I could have probably collected another, you know, couple hundred thousand dollars. But, you know, back then my priorities were, you know, were strictly, you know, me doing what I wanted to do, and had nothing, really wrestling wasn't a part of that at the time.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, while this was going on, it, you know, they just recently shut the ECW brand down, and a lot of people were happy that they just let it, you know, die out. Not die out, but you know what I mean, like just kind of sit on the back burner and them not destroy it anymore. And now TNA, of course, is going to be doing the Hardcore Justice pay-per-view on August 8th. Is there any chance fans might see you a part of that, or have you even been contacted?
Is there any chance? Well, I mean, I guess. Well, you know, let's see. It's called Hardcore Justice, right? And it's a tribute to ECW. I guess there's a chance I'm going to be on it. You know, there's a chance I may have talked to Terry Taylor on the phone today, you know. There's a chance that you know, I could have talked to Tommy Dreamer about it. There's a chance all these things are possible. Do I know this for sure? Yeah, I do, but I'm not telling you. You know, because like the TNA website will tell you more names are going to be announced as, you know, as they want to. But, you know, just put it to you like this. It's a tribute to ECW. I was a big part of ECW. And if asked to do it, of course I would do it. And I would love to. And it's like, because if you think about all the things that go on in the wrestling business, isn't it strange how this band of, you know, misfit, you know, weren't good enough for anybody else, or too old for everybody else, or too fat, or too young, or too old. Guys from a little bingo hall in Philadelphia created such a nasty stain on the wrestling business that some 15 to 20 years later, the fans still yell for us, and they beg for ECW to please come and save the wrestling business again. That's all they're doing. The fans are asking us to do what we did in the mid-90s one more time. They're saying Tommy Dreamer, Sabu, Raven, Sandman, Axel Rotten, Shane Douglas, Balls Mahoney, New Jack, please come save us again, because what we have right now is what we don't want. And, you know, the fans have spoken. The fans have spoken to the tune of WWE was forced to do an ECW pay-per-view. TNA is doing an ECW pay-per-view. Do you think that if ECW were managed correctly, ECW would be the number one wrestling company in the world today, because still the fans can't get enough of what we did? So on August 8th, all I will say to the fans out there, you know, I would order the pay-per-view if I were you, because if you want to have a little bit of nostalgia as to what ECW was about, this is a great time to do it. And if, you know, you never got a chance to see the original ECW in its inception, this will probably be the closest that you're going to get to seeing it, is August 8th on pay-per-view at Hardcore Justice. And I would definitely suggest that if you have the opportunity to order that pay-per-view, because if I know what I know about the way I feel, about the way I want to be represented as an ECW original and or legend, when the time comes, I'm going to go out there and give the people everything that I can. And I know Tommy Dreamer is going to do the same thing. I know Sandman, Sabu, and anyone else that's affiliated, Raven, Stevie Richards, I know they will all do the same thing. Bubba, Devon, because the love that we have for ECW in our hearts, you know, no matter where you may go, if you went to WWE, if you went to TNA, when you put that certain group of guys together, there's something that happens. And on August 8th, I have a feeling that, you know, once again, the planets are going to align one more time, and we're going to give the people something that they're really going to be talking about for a long time to come.
Now, of course, you know, TNA is trying to do it. You said WWE even did it. Now, while ECW was still around, there was a company on the West Coast called Extreme Pro Wrestling run by Rob Black, who tried to do it, you know, on the West Coast, and eventually ended up trying to take over your guys' arena. What are your memories of working for Rob Black?
Well, you know, it was a weird time because ECW still existed in a little bit of a way, but at the time, you know, I was let go. Candido was fired at the time. Shane Douglas, you know, we were all, like, you know, over there working for Rob, and it was very weird because I'm in the locker room, and, you know, walking around, I'm seeing, like, you know, Ron Jeremy and, like, you know, like Amber Lynn and, like, porno stars that I remember watching when I was, like, a kid, you know. And I'm like, well, this is strange, isn't it? You know, there's, like, you know, porn stars hanging out in the wrestling show. XPW was interesting, and it probably could have been bigger, but, you know, Rob Black just wasn't the guy to do it. He just wanted to be a star, and his ego wouldn't allow him to put on shows, you know, for the fans, more so to put on shows for himself, to get himself over. And, you know, it was a good time, you know, as far as good times go, but, you know, it could have been a lot better for wrestling. But it was, you know, hanging out in L.A. with, you know, porn stars, stuff was fun, you know, rock stars, porn stars, whatever. We had a good time. But, you know, the wrestling itself, you know, could have been a lot better if it had been given an opportunity to have some sort of direct creative control, which it wasn't.
Now, of course, you know, after XPW closed down, the rights were pretty much let go, and Big Vision Entertainment bought them out and ran the Cold Day in Hell pay-per-view, which was a one-time event, like a reunion like the ECW. Were you contacted to do that? I know New Jack, Raven, Sabu, Terry Funk, they were all there. Were you ever contacted about that?
No, I had nothing to do with that. You know, I only even found out about it like a couple days before it happened. So it was actually probably not that big of a deal.
Wow, it was actually surprising. They even had C.W. Anderson there, which C.W. didn't do much for XPW, so it's kind of weird.
Well, I probably was in contact because I was probably out on some, no one could get a hold of me and know whether I was alive or dead, you know?
Yeah. Now, I just had one last question for you, and that's, do you have any ribs or road stories you can share with our listeners?
Oh, man, there's just too many. You know, there was... man, I can't be quick about it. Wrestling, let's put it this way, you know, when you get a bunch of grown men together who are traveling around the country, play fighting and dressing up in spandex for a living, there's going to be a lot of goofiness that goes along with it. So, you know, just put it this way, I had a lot of great times with a lot of great guys and a lot of great cities all over this country. So, you know, it was a great time.
Definitely. Do you have anything you can plug to our listeners, upcoming events, Facebook, MySpace, something that you'd like our fans to be able to get a hold of you on?
Well, sure, man. If you want to go to, you know, MySpace, you know, .com, it's just Axel Rotten. on Facebook, you can search Axel Rotten or my real name, Brian Knighton. You know, I'm under that. And of course, like I said, don't cheat yourself. On August 8th, order that TNA pay-per-view, Hardcore Justice, without question. You know, if Axel Rotten shows up, it can only be better. If Axel Rotten shows up with Balls Mahoney, hint, hint, it can only even be better. So I would suggest that you go ahead and order that one. It's going to be a great time.
Definitely. Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
You had a great time, guys. Thanks for having me on. To all the fans out there, Hardcore Justice, August 8th on pay-per-view.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Axel.
Thanks, guys. All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye. All right, ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard a very exclusive, sounds like we just got some hints as to what I just heard. So, will they or will they not be there? That is the question. We will have Balls Mahoney on next Wednesday. That's right, fans, next Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific, blogtalkradio.com/FCR-live. Of course, falsecountradio.com. Andrew, any final thoughts, man?
No, this was a great night. We had two incredible interviews. Look on my Facebook, I was talking about how incredible it was as we were doing this interview. There was a couple of questions we didn't get the chance to ask because he answered everything so in depth.
Oh, yeah. You know, and some great stories. We're going to have to get him back on again another time. I wish Gary Wolf would have been a part of this. We'll have to get Gary on and do it on a Saturday. But this Saturday, of course, we are going to be doing another episode. Gary Wolf, myself, and possibly a special guest co-host from ECW. I will not say who, but let's just say that we'll welcome him back to the announce table. With that being said, I'm the Pacific Coast Player, JT Evans, saying stay safe, have a good night, and if you didn't listen to this interview, man, sucks to be you, but you better check out the Kid Cash interview from earlier tonight. We're out of here. Hit the theme.